Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1. Let's hear the word of the Lord together. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light, rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth, he looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered, the everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place, at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will wait, quietly wait, for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot, is regarded by many as one of the most significant plays of the 20th century. It's about two tramps who are hanging around, doing nothing, waiting for a third person, Godot, to come. But he never does. They're bored. For them, life is without meaning or purpose. And the play ends with them saying that tomorrow they'll hang themselves unless Godot comes to save them. It's pretty bleak stuff. It pictures the absurdity of life and the human condition. Hanging around, waiting for God, maybe, to show up, but he never does. But believers can sometimes feel like that too. Frustrated that God hasn't shown up, that he hasn't answered our prayers, that he hasn't intervened in our lives as we want, or that he allows suffering and evil in the wider world to continue unchecked. Waiting for God to show up, wondering if he ever will, and tempted to give up. It's how the prophet Habakkuk felt back in the 7th century BC. God's people he lived among in Judah, they were going their own way. They were ignoring God's law, with sinful behavior spreading like a virus. And God was doing nothing. He was just watching. And so Habakkuk cried out, "How long, O Lord, and why?" And God replied that he was going to show up again, that he would raise up the Babylonians to invade Judah, bringing God's judgment on them. And Habakkuk then questioned how God could use the wicked Babylonians against his own people. And God replied that in time he would too judge the Babylonians as well. So God was going to show up in judgment on Judah and then on Babylon, but the righteous who live by faith would be saved. That's where we've got to by the end of chapter 2. And the question it's left us with is, well, how is Habakkuk going to respond to what God has revealed? And that is what we have now in chapter 3. Habakkuk could have responded with skepticism. He could have said, well, you know, sure, I'll believe that when I see it. Or he could have responded with rejection. He could have said, well, sounds totally unreasonable to me, what you're proposing. But instead, he responds with faith. And he gives us a model of how the righteous by faith are to wait for God's coming, how we're to live in this time of waiting for God to show up, and how we are to cope with what may be dark days. Firstly, then, you'll see on the outline, we are to believe in God's coming. Verses 1 to 2 tell us why we can be sure that God will come, that he will show up. So we're back on page 950, Habakkuk 3, verse 1. So a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, according to Shigionoth, which is probably a musical term. O Lord, he says, I have heard the report of you, and your work do I fear. Habakkuk has heard what the Lord is like and what the Lord has done. So his work of judging and saving. And he's heard it in what God revealed to him personally. So in God's answers to his questions in chapters 1 and 2. But he also heard it in the scriptures which he had. The word report here means what you have heard from somebody else. So he's heard and he's read there in the scriptures of God's coming in judgment and salvation. In the past, in salvation history, recorded in scripture. What did he have in mind? Well, all sorts of examples. Think of the flood in Genesis. The Lord came in judgment on the world, but he saved Noah and seven of his family in the ark. Think of Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord came in judgment, destroyed those sinful cities, but he saved Lot and three of his family. Think of the Exodus. The Lord came in judgment on Pharaoh and Egypt, but he saved his people, led by Moses. And at the Red Sea in judgment, he came and destroyed the Egyptian armies, but he brought his people through on dry land. Think of that generation who left Egypt. The Lord came in judgment on them for their rebellion, and they perished in the wilderness. But God saved two, Joshua and Caleb, and he brought them into the promised land. Think of the nations in the promised land. The Lord came in judgment on them, but he saved his people. And he destroyed Jericho, but he saved Rahab. All these reports of the Lord's work, his coming in judgment and salvation, Habakkuk had heard. He'd read them. And this now gave him confidence that God would show up again. Before, he'd questioned whether God was going to do anything, and now he was sure. And on this basis, he prays in chapter two, in verse 2b, the second half, he says in 2b, in the midst of the years, revive it. That is your work. Revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So he now prays with confidence. Lord, what you have done before, do it again. Come in judgment. But when you do, remember mercy. Be merciful to the righteous by faith. And sure enough, God did show up again. He came in judgment on Judah, but he preserved a remnant who went into exile. And then in time, he came in judgment on Babylon. And again, he was merciful, and he preserved a remnant whom he brought back to the land of Judah. Like Habakkuk, we are to look back on God's comings in history And we can now look back on God showing up big time in a way that Habakkuk could never have imagined. Centuries after Habakkuk, the Lord visited his people again in remembrance of his mercy, as Luke 1 puts it, that in Jesus the eternal Son of God became man. And on the cross, God came in judgment on the sin of his people, and he brought salvation. And on the cross, we see both wrath and mercy, as in verse 2. As we've just sung, we worship at your feet where wrath and mercy meet. We live in a world in which God has showed up in the most staggering way. And in the light of this coming of God in Christ in history past, we too look forward with confidence that God will come again in another and ultimate act of judgment and salvation. It's not wishful thinking. We live between these two comings of God in Christ, his first coming and his promised return. And this is the framework for our lives. And when he does come again, he will deal with all the evil in the world once and for all. And he will save his people, the righteous by faith. It's like one of those IQ questions where you're given a series of shapes or numbers, and based on the pattern you identify, you can work out what the final one is, the final one in the series. Well, we see the pattern of salvation and judgment in history. God coming to judge and to save. And there's just one blank left. With Christ's return, the sequence will be complete. But what is it like when God comes? So when he does show up, what is it actually like? Well, that's what verses 3 to 16 are about. And it may be rather different to what we imagine. One summer, we went as a family to a safari park in Sweden, in the middle of which is a wooden roller coaster. Wildfire, as they call it, is it's the fastest wooden one in Europe and the second tallest in the world. And one of our kids was absolutely desperate to do this and could not be persuaded otherwise. Could hardly sort of contain his excitement. But I think it's fair to say that it ended up being the most terrifying 2 minutes of his little life. When you stagger off this thing at the end, the shop that you go through, the little gift shop, displays a photo taken of you partway through the ride. And I've never seen such terror on his face. So a mouth open in horror, eyes bloodshot from pulling 4G, and sort of never ever again. When God comes, when he does show up, it's going to be so very different to what so many people imagine. Some have an attitude now of, oh, it doesn't bother me, it's going to be fine. Might actually be a little bit uncomfortable for God when I put my difficult questions to him. In these verses, we get an insight into what it actually is like when God comes. What Habakkuk witnesses, what he sees and hears, it leaves him in a state of shock. So if you look at verse 16, at the end of this vision, verse 16, he says, I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound, rottenness enters my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. He's in quite a state. Body trembling, lips quivering, heart pounding, legs buckling beneath him. And this is one of God's friends. What will it be like for his enemies? Well, what did he witness that impacted him in such a profound way? The vision here in 3 to 15 seems to be a collage of images from the past in biblical history. In verses 3 to 7, there's this poetic description of God's coming in awesome splendor. And just try and visualize what this is describing. Imagine what it would be like to be there. So look at verse 3. It says, God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. So the radiance of the divine splendor is like the sun up close. Verse 4 says, rays flashed from his hand, maybe sun rays, maybe lightning. And verse 4 says, and there he veiled his power. So what's on display is only a tiny fraction of his power. Verse 5, before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. So as the Egyptians experienced in Exodus. Verse 6 says, he stood and measured the earth. So having come down, God stands there, sort of towering over the earth like some colossus, evaluating the earth. Verse 6, he looked and shook the nations, you know, like we might shake some ketchup bottle. Verse 6, then the eternal mountains were scattered, the everlasting hills sank low. So the massive ancient mountains, which seem so stable, so permanent, but they just crumble and they're shattered as if hit by some giant sledgehammer. Verse 6, his were the everlasting ways. So he alone is eternal. Verse 6, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. So the nations react with terror. Shockwaves spread. Panic takes hold. This is what Habakkuk witnessed in his vision. God coming in awesome majesty, splendor, glory. When many years later God came down in Jesus, the surprise was that his glory and power were so hidden. He came as a baby in weakness. When Jesus grew up, became a man, witnesses testified, they said, we have seen his glory, but it was a glory largely veiled. A glimpse at the transfiguration. Peter, who was there witnessing it, said, he testified, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And they did witness his power in his miracles. But again, so much of his power was hidden. And on the cross, he seemed so powerless, so helpless. And even though in the resurrection he was declared with power to be the Son of God, it wasn't on the kind of scale we see here in Habakkuk 3. But it will be when Jesus returns. Of his return, Jesus himself said in Matthew 24, for as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. All the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and with great glory. And what the rest of Habakkuk saw in this vision will be fulfilled. There's a church in Worksop which ran a competition in which entrants were asked to submit their answer to the question, what is God like? And the winner was Mrs. H.J. Thompson from Welbeck, who compared God to her old geranium. Another entrant said that God was a scented rose, and another compared him to a gentle morning dew. It's all very pleasant, very reassuring, harmless, and nothing like what God revealed to Habakkuk. In verses 8 to 15, second half of the vision, God is not a scented rose, but a victorious warrior. So having seen in verses 3 to 7 God's coming in awesome splendor, we now see why he has come. He's come for battle. He's come to wage war. So have a look at verse 8. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers? Or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? So three words, anger, indignation, wrath. God has come in judgment. Was his judgment on the natural world, the rivers and the sea? It seemed so, didn't it, back at the Red Sea and what he did with the Red Sea in Exodus. But actually, God's judgment was against his enemies. Verse 9, you strip the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. So God comes like a warrior going into battle in his chariot with his bow and his arrows at the ready. And the natural world reels under the impact of his coming. Verse 9. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted up its hands on high. It's picturing a massive earthquake, a tsunami, and the flooding that follows. Verse 11, the sun and moon stood still in their places at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. So the sun and the moon are awestruck, time stops, whose weapons flash. And the final verses describe the outcome. It was never in doubt, it was a one-sided contest. God is victorious. Verse 12, you marched through the earth in fury, you threshed the nations in anger. A threshing sledge was a board with jagged bits underneath, and you dragged it over grain to separate the wheat from the chaff. And it pictures here the total and the painful defeat of God's enemies. But salvation for his people, verse 13, you went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head, that is the leader, of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck, so stripping the armor off the defeated enemy. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. And again, the surprise is that when God showed up in Jesus, he really didn't look like a victorious warrior, not riding in a chariot, but lying in a manger, hanging on a cross. But even in that first coming, God was waging war in the spiritual world. He was coming in judgment on sin and on the devil. He, as Colossians 2:15 puts it, he disarmed the rulers and authorities at the cross. And as a result, Satan was defeated. John 12, Jesus said of his death, now will the ruler of this world be cast out, the head of the ancient serpent crushed. But when God shows up again at Jesus' return, it will be much more obviously as the Habakkuk 3 victorious warrior. And it will be utterly terrifying. Revelation chapter 6 describes the scene. Revelation 6:14 says, the sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place, and everyone hid themselves, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? Our first reading that Roger read, Revelation 19:11-21, it pictured Jesus, didn't it, riding at the head of the armies of heaven, coming for the final battle against the forces of evil and defeating them. Destroying, as 1 Corinthians 15 puts it, destroying every rule and every authority and power and putting all his enemies under his feet. The person who thinks that God is a scented rose or a geranium or the gentle morning dew is in for a shock. God is a warrior who will come in terrifying judgment on his enemies and to save his people. Douglas Adams wrote the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series of novels. The fifth one in the series is called Mostly Harmless. And the title is referring to the earth, but it's actually how many people view God. Mostly harmless, old bloke in the sky, a little bit doddery. And Habakkuk chapter 3 is a reality check. It tells us the truth of what it is really like when God comes. And if we are his people, those who are righteous by faith, even though we look forward to salvation, not judgment, we should be in awe of God. Hebrews 12:28 says, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. In centuries past, the church probably had a clearer view of this than we do today. In today's church, the tendency is probably a bit more towards God is your best mate. But Habakkuk 3 is a corrective. So God is coming to judge and to save, but that's not now. I mean, that's future. What about now? What about today? How should we live today as God's people in the present? That's what the final verses of the book are about as we wait for God's coming. Firstly, we're to wait quietly. Verse 16, second half. Yet he says, I will wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. Habakkuk was certain now that God was going to come at his appointed time and judge their enemies. That's the Babylonians who were to invade them. And he was content to wait quietly now for that day. Now that's quite different, isn't it, to the Habakkuk of chapters 1 and 2. I mean, back then he was fed up with waiting. And back then he was noisy in his frustrated complaints and questioning of God. I wonder which Habakkuk you would identify with most. If we recognize ourselves more in the questioning prophet of chapters 1 to 2, as we look at evil and suffering in the world and in our own lives, that isn't wrong. But the answers that God gave him in chapters 1 and 2 should help us to move forward to the quiet waiting of chapter 3. Assured that God will come in judgment and salvation and waiting patiently for that. Living quiet lives of godliness. And in love, warning others. But this time of waiting is going to have plenty of challenges. And it certainly did for Habakkuk. Although he knew that God was ultimately going to come in judgment on the Babylonians, that was a long way off. And in the meantime, very, very dark days lay ahead for God's people as the Babylonians prepared to invade Judah. Have a look at verse 17. It describes the effect of that invasion on the economy. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the field yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. With the ravages of war, the land would be left desolate. It wasn't just luxury produce that would disappear from the shelves, figs, grapes, olives, but even necessities, bread, milk, meat. These hardships were going to hit all of God's people in Judah, including Habakkuk and the other faithful. So it's not just the wicked in Judah who were going to experience this. The righteous by faith remnant would be caught up in this too, kind of collateral damage. And so for us as New Testament believers, although God's judgment on our sin has been paid by Christ on the cross, we still live in a world that has gone its own way and is under God's judgment. A world ravaged by sickness and death, by disease and disability, by war and conflict, by tragedy and sorrow, by work pressures and bereavement and relationship breakdown. And the righteous by faith do not escape these trials. And in addition, we face opposition for Christ and God's fatherly discipline of his children. The prosperity gospel preachers, they tell you that everything's going to work out in your life if you have faith. But Habakkuk knew differently, as did Job, and as did Jesus, and as did Paul, and as do New Testament believers who read their Bibles. A guy called Richard Chin, who works in student ministry in Australia, he describes the time when his wife died. He says it was a horrendous time to see this beautiful, healthy woman turn into almost a skeleton by the time she passed away. It was awful. To see my wife of 23 years go through that suffering and pain was awful. Habakkuk and Job became close friends, and so did the psalmists. Habakkuk is a good friend to have. Okay, we've got to know him a bit over these past 3 weeks. And for some here, he may already have become a really good friend, a big help to you in the challenges that you're facing right now. But even if life is good for you at the moment, stay in touch with him. Stay in touch, because he's the sort of friend you may need in days to come. And his perspective in the final verses is quite a challenge. So having listed all these trials that were going to come, look at what he then says in verse 18. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. He resolved that he would rejoice in the Lord. Even if everything was taken away, he would still, well, he still had the Lord. And he knew that the Lord would one day come. And so he could take joy in him. We just sung this song, Blessed Be Your Name, by Matt and Beth Redmond. And it's all about this resolve to rejoice in the Lord, whatever our circumstances. And they've actually written a book with the same title. The subtitle of the book is Worshipping God on a Road Marked with Suffering. Let me read to you what they write in the introduction. In the introduction, they write this. Since writing the song, we've heard so many stories of how the people of God have responded to him in trust and praise in some of the harshest circumstances we've ever come across. Letters, conversations, emails have unveiled many different tales of abuse, rejection, heartache, or stories of those who've lost loved ones in the most shocking of circumstances. Yet there is a common theme linking all of these reports together, a determined choice to press on with lives of praise amidst a world of pain. All of these worshippers have found themselves surrounded by the storms of life, and yet they have responded to Jesus with a faithful cry of blessed be your name in their hearts. Rejoice in the Lord always. Well, that is Habakkuk's perspective here at the end. Verse 19, he says, God, the Lord is my strength, and he makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. It's a picture of victory. In Psalm 18, verse 33, you've got David as he's celebrating God delivering him from Saul. He says this, that God made my feet like the feet of a deer and set me secure on the heights. Even in the harshest circumstances, as we find our strength in the Lord and we rejoice in him, it's saying we can experience victory. More than conquerors through him who loved us. Verse 19 ends, to the choir master with stringed instruments. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that chapter 3 was actually a song for God's people to use in worship. It was a song to sustain God's people through the dark days that lay ahead and to sustain us as well. So this final line there was a note to the head of the music group. He's saying that, you know, this one is to be sung with the stringed instruments. So the guitars, the lyres, the cellos, and so on. And in verse 1, he even noted down the tune they were to sing it to, according to the Shigionoth, probably a musical term, as are the three references to Selah that we find in the margin in the Psalms as well, and here. The righteous by faith may experience many dark days as we wait for God's final coming to judge and to save. But in the darkness and the difficulties, in trials and tears, Habakkuk calls us to find our strength and our joy in him, in the Lord, and to praise him. John Newton, the converted slave trader, writer of hymns such as Amazing Grace, he kept a diary. And his entry for Sunday 26, December 1790, reads as follows. This evening I preached a funeral sermon for my deceased earthly comfort, who was removed, I trust, to a better world on the 15th. Sermon from Habakkuk 3, 17 to 18. That John Newton had saved this passage specially to preach on at his wife's funeral. A good friend of Newton's was the poet William Cowper. and he struggled with severe depression right through his life. And one of the hymns that he wrote was a meditation on these verses in Habakkuk. His hymn went, "Though vine nor fig tree neither their wanted fruit should bear, though all the field should wither, nor flocks nor herds be there, yet God the same abiding, his praise shall tune my voice, for while in him confiding, I cannot but rejoice." This little book of Habakkuk traces a journey. It's a journey from complaining, questioning prophet, to rejoicing, praising prophet. In his book, How Long, O Lord, Don Carson, the theologian, tells the following story. He says, on a trip to Australia, I met an Anglican bishop who had been mightily used in evangelism and church planting in three African nations. He was sometimes referred to as the Apostle of Tanzania. After he retired from his missionary work in Africa, he set up a seminary in the United States. But he says, when I met him, he was suffering from Parkinson's disease, and it was so advanced that he could no longer talk. He could communicate just barely by printing in block letters in a wavering hand that was almost indecipherable. He often had to draw a word three or four times for me to understand him. Carson says, we talked, in inverted commas, about a number of matters close to his heart. At least, he says, I did the talking, and I tried to ask most of my questions in a form where he could signal merely yes or no. In the short time I spent with him, I sensed a man of unshaken faith, and so I had the boldness to ask him how he was coping with his illness. After decades of immensely productive activity, how was he dealing with his own suffering, with the temptation to feel that he was now useless and fruitless? And Carson says he penned his answer twice before I could make it out, writing in block capitals. And he wrote this, "There is no future in frustration." Habakkuk came to the same conclusion. The book begins with complaint and it ends in joy. It begins with frustration and it ends in faith. It begins with perplexity and it ends in praise, despite many calamities. For now we sing songs in the night, but we do so knowing that soon the eternal dawn will come and day will break and the sun will rise. And the righteous by faith will then receive the salvation and the Savior for which they have been quietly waiting.